You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
Hey, queers, welcome back. This is our final episode of season 3, and it's episode 12. Thesis on Joan is a podcast dedicated to amplifying voices from the LGBTQ plus community in the New York performing arts scene and examining the industry from a queer perspective. Join us as we sit down with groundbreaking theater folks, both on stage and behind the curtain. For many queers, theater has been an escape, and this podcast looks to have open conversations on where we've come from and where we're headed as a community while queering the canon along the way.
Hey, Arrow, how's it going?
It's good. I can't believe we're at the end of this season. It's been such a wild year.
Yeah, it's thinking back to the spring and kind of mapping everything out. Like, before, I hadn't even seen Strange Loop yet when this season started.
Wow. Now you've seen it twice?
Three times.
Nice.
Yeah. Yes. Hoping for
I've
a fourth.
I've seen it three times total. Yeah.
Oh, yeah, because you saw it once off-Broadway, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we got to tie Trevor Noah with four times.
Goals in my life to just tie Trevor Noah on most things.
On most things. I think this might be the only thing I can actually tie him on.
Sure, yeah.
So we were planning to have an interview for this episode, but queers are busy, which is great.
Yeah. Yeah, we got a lot of yeses and then a lot of, we'll talk in January. So yeah. Season 4 is already pretty planned out, which is exciting.
Yeah, it's like such night and day from the beginning of the podcast when, you know, everyone's like, I'm available, whatever, you know, and now it's like, I'm working, which we love. So that makes us happy. Yeah.
Yeah. And we still have plenty to talk about.
Oh, always. Yes. Yeah, and at the end we'll do a little year wrap up. But first we saw a couple, well, we saw more than a couple, but there's a couple shows we're going to talk about since we last had our show roundup. So we got the chance to see Anne Juliet. Harrow, what were you thinking going into the show?
I was excited. I had seen exciting things about it on social media. I knew there was like a queer non-binary character in it, and I was that's a person of color, and so I was super excited to see how that played out. And this was like the music of my adolescence and what I grew up really loving. So I was excited for the score too.
It's such like millennial bait. Like, I don't even think I realized how much so until I got in there, and I was not upset about that.
Oh, no. I mean, overall, I'd say I had a great time, and I would see it again in a heartbeat.
Yeah, I would agree with that. And I think, like, when I was, I don't know if it had just opened or was about to open, but like way, way back 2019 when I was in London for Come From Away, I think it was about to run. I forget, but everyone, all I heard about it was, it's really fun time. You should see it. So I feel like that didn't convince me enough to do it. So hopefully our conversation will enlighten people a little bit more of like why it's fun and why they should see it.
Yeah. And it is a jukebox musical. It's all the music from Max Martin, with the book by David West Reed. But I would say this is probably one of the most enjoyable jukebox musicals I've ever seen.
Yeah. I think it might be the best one. I'm trying to think. Uh-huh. I don't want to say the best, but one of the best, because what I loved about it so much that I'm still thinking about, and one of the reasons I would go back to see it again, is how well the lyrics are actually tied to the story. So it feels more like traditional musical theater. Like the songs are not just asides, like, you know, this song, this is so fun. It's like, this song is actually propelling the story forward to the point where they even changed some lyrics to help that.
Yeah, I'd say there's definitely some moments where it really didn't work for me, but which we'll talk about later. But yeah, overall, I agree. I think like this feels very different from like Jersey Boys, where it's trying to really like tell the story of the artist. And it was really refreshing to like not have that like standard to meet, I guess. And so it's a retelling, or it's a telling of Romeo and Juliet if Juliet had not died and what would happen afterwards, right? So it's a whole original story. And that kind of made it feel like a new original musical.
Yeah, agreed. It felt like totally new because you had no idea what was going to happen next. You know, it hit a lot of the Shakespearean beats of like lovers entangling and disentangling and, you know, people being in the wrong place, wrong time. But
yeah,
like all still very new concept.
Yeah. And they tried to really put like a feminist twist on it as well, I'd say, which was kind of at the level of like, I was like, what Six is of like, kind of girl power-y that I wish could have gone like a little deeper, but it was fine.
Yeah, the girl power like felt very like when we were kids, like vibe of girl power. You know what I mean? Wasn't like kind of modern day, more nuanced look at that. But I mean, but it was being delivered by Betsy Wolf, so I have very few complaints.
The love of Betsy Wolf just grew exponentially. I already loved her so much.
She's so good. And like, I can't believe someone else played this role already, right? Because it feels like they just made it for her. That's what it felt like.
I really appreciated how comedic she got to be. She's not like a typical ingenue, and I'm so glad that she got to showcase that. And, you know, her voice is gorgeous, of course. I will say, I wish they hadn't had her sing a Celine Dion song as her like 11 o'clock number, because she's not Celine Dion, and that's hard to compare.
Oh yeah. I like forgot what she, she still knocked it out of the park, but you're right. If they give it her something that like she could clearly, you know, do better than the recording artist, it might have been better. Yeah. She's the best written character too.
Definitely. She just has such a, like, a musical theater voice compared to, like, a pop diva voice that I think.
Yeah.
It just fell off to me.
And that hit a couple times. I feel like that's inevitable, but not as, like, for me anyway, not as kind of off-putting as it was in Moulin Rouge, where people were actually, like, when I was laughing at the song inclusion, it was, like, with the characters, you know, mostly, rather than like, oh, this is a weird bad choice, which is how I felt about Moulin Rouge quite a bit.
I haven't seen it yet. Maybe one day.
I mean, it's still a fun experience. It's just the music is not as artfully put together as it is for this show, I would say.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So there are definitely some moments where I'm like, oh, this doesn't work with these singers. With the first time Paolo Zott sang, I think it's Firework or Teenage Dream with a duet with the nurse character. And his like voice is so gorgeous and this like deep baritone operatic voice that like it's funny at first and then it just kept going and then I'm like, no, now it's just awkward.
I thought it was funny though. Like I felt like it was kind of like, man, this guy has a beautiful voice and I'm sorry that we're all like laughing at it, but it did feel like he was kind of in on it too.
So. It's true. His second song I thought was gorgeous. Did he sing Shape of My Heart?
Yes.
Yeah. I thought that was beautiful.
And that song too was like one of the many instances where they took something, you know, mostly these are Max Martin pop songs. So they're like very traditional, like pop love songs, but like that was for his son, right? That was the context of that song.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. And so I thought there were some cool moments where they showed like the different ways that you could relate these songs to like the real world. So. Mm-hmm. Or whatever this world is. That was a thing I kept getting confused with. I'm like, where are we? What time period is it? But it doesn't matter.
Yeah. Can we talk about the maid character?
Yeah. I know Lucy had a lot of ideas about that too. Well, she told me on the train, but go ahead.
No, I thought it was exciting to see the nurse character be a woman of color who had a name and who was much more developed than just like Juliet's nursemaid.
Yeah. And was like hot. It was like sexy.
Yeah. I I felt weird about the power dynamics. Okay, we're going to talk spoilers, right? So I felt weird about the power dynamics between her and Paolo's character, who was like her former employer and also former lover, you find out. And there was like no discussion about that. Like, I guess it's better that they end up together in act two and she doesn't work for him anymore. But I'm like, oh, this relationship started in a dynamic that was not okay.
Yeah. And it's like, she clearly, I feel like they try to counterbalance that with like, she clearly has a lot of like power over him because he's like obsessed with her. But like, it's still, there's a lot about her that feels that you want it filled in. Like, I'm also confused on like her accent choice too.
Yeah.
Like, why is she the only character besides him? He has this like over the top French accent that seems like it's there for comedy, right? But I hope that hers isn't there for comedy, because it's like, I don't even know how to describe it, like Jamaica, Bahamas, like regional accent. And
I was just looking at her Instagram and it does seem like she has an accent in life, so that might just be like
how
she
really
speaks. So that also made me feel better.
It's a pregnant Thomas Jefferson situation.
Yeah. It does sound a little, I don't know, because I was just watching some of her Instagram stories and it doesn't sound as like intense, but it just might be because it's not like a heightened theatrical, you know, setting. I thought they were going to get into imperialism and colonization at one moment, because at one point, she speaks French and Juliet's like, I didn't know you spoke French. And she's like, well, and it's like a mystery moment. And I'm like, oh, we're going to talk about colonization and imperialization of like wherever she's from and the French. And that is not at all what was that moment was about.
Yeah. I don't know what that moment was in service of. Like, ooh, adults can be surprising. Like, I don't understand what that was there for. It felt like, it felt like a promise of a deeper show that doesn't exist here.
I mean, I think it was supposed to hint that like, she was in France and then she had this like former lover
this
and former
fling.
Life.
Yeah.
Yeah. But I really, I was really excited for a second and then let down, but it's okay.
Yeah. She does have a pretty incredible speech in the second act that I'd like people actually stopped and applauded for. That was really amazing. That was impressive.
Also her, singing perfect to Juliet.
Yes.
I cried.
Yeah, that was so moving. Yeah, their relationship was really cool. And I don't know what else to say about it. It just felt very like genuine, that relationship.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And like to see a woman of color sing that to another woman of color. And like that was very, that was very moving. And I felt like rare to see on Broadway in a musical.
Yeah. Passed the Bechdel test.
Yeah. And I love that song too. From, I remember listening to that in high school and being like,
There is a lot of nostalgia moments. I feel like you could kind of, everyone had like a moment during the show where it's like, oh, this song. You know, you hear like the first chords of a Backstreet Boys song. You're like, I know what this is.
I found a playlist, I think, of like, the songs of Anne Juliet, but like the original. And I was just listening to that in a car that I was driving the other day. It was very fun.
Oh, I should do that. I should look that up. But yeah, we should talk about May, the character of May, who is played, by the actor Justin David Sullivan. And is like Juliet's best friend that was kind of like added into the story early when Anne is doing her like live rewrites with Will. So in the script, May enters and Will asks, like, isn't May more of a girl's name, which we hear once we see the character step on stage. And then Anne says something about how Will is like the original gender bender with plays, which is, yes, I guess, but it was mostly because women weren't allowed to act. So I'm like, I don't really buy that. It's not like he actively chose to have men play women in his plays.
Right.
And then Anne says, do you think it's up to you to question May's gender or sexuality? Or do you think maybe May is whoever May is and it's really none of your business? So I'm like, okay, May is non-binary.
Yeah, that made me think May is non-binary. But I also was like, but what are May's pronouns?
Yeah, not established, right?
Yeah.
And not, I don't know. We'd have to go through and look, but I was like listening for it and I don't remember pronouns being used for May, like mm-hmm. throughout the show.
And I think like, it feels like this is the general sense of how Broadway is approaching non-binary genderqueer characters right now, where it's like vague. They're figuring it out. We don't want to label anybody. And I'm like, yeah, that's cool. That's definitely like people's experience. But I'm like, I also just want like, this is a non-binary character and they use they, them pronouns or zemzir or like whatever, because I just feel like you are just trying to be the safest. Like they're like, oh, we need to leave this open to as many possible casting choices as possible or like as many interpretations yeah. as possible. And I'm like, no, I want like clarity a bit. Like, yeah, it just feels a little bit like a cop out.
And also that line came from, I know that Anne is like the creator in this moment, but that line came from Anne and not from May, you know, on their own saying like, well, maybe it doesn't matter. You know, like if it came from the character, I'd be like, okay, I have a much better sense of what this character, how this character is identifying because they told me, not because some woman on stage told me. You know?
Yeah. So. Cause these characters are being essentially written by Anne Hathaway, the original. And it's like, what does this cis white woman from, you know, Shakespeare's time period know about, you know, different, like gender identity? I don't trust that like she's the expert.
She does not. Yeah. And the anachronisms and the like, it's like clear that we're supposed to kind of believe that it's during Shakespearean time, but it's also like, I don't know. There's a lot of like little props and asides and things that make it very current. So it exists in another space. That's
yeah. I love the costumes though.
Costumes are so cool.
So great. Very like six reminiscent in times, but just like the combo of like modern streetwear and like Elizabethan clothes was awesome.
Yeah. And those costumes were by Paloma Young, who did the Natasha Pierre costumes, which were also very like of an old world and also the current world, which I loved. So
I did love Justin's performance. I think they're a beautiful singer and a beautiful person and felt really grounded.
Yeah. And May's character is just so endearing. Like they're so earnest and also like so... I don't know. They're just so kind to Juliet and like a good friend to Juliet. And it was good to see a character that was like that, you know, knowing all the shit that Juliet goes through. I think she needed a character like May and she needs her nurse to be these grounded, like complicated, but like kind people, I guess.
Mm-hmm. We do need to talk about May's first song.
Yes.
They got to sing I'm Not a Girl, Not Yet a Woman, the Britney Spears classic. And I was very confused by this. I'm just like, they really wanted the song in the show, or they're just like, oh, this song mentions gender, so it would be a good song for May.
I think that was my assumption is the latter. And like, this is early, right? This is like, what, half hour into the show, and I was like having so much fun. I'm like, oh no, don't make me not like you and Juliet. Like I'm in, you know, I'm having so much fun, and I'm like still not okay with the choice because I don't know. I think they just need to pick a lane with this character because they keep wanting to be like, maybe it doesn't matter, you know, how May identifies. And they're like, let's give May only songs with really gendered messages. Yeah. Because their next song is I Kissed a Girl.
Yeah.
And I'm like, there are so many songs that Max Martin wrote. Why are we picking the two, like, specific girl? I don't know. And, like, you know, also, they did a beautiful job, but...
Yeah, and then at the end of Not a Girl, they're like, but I'm not a girl. So we're just invalidating the whole song.
Yeah. So that was one of the instances where it's like, this song didn't do anything to help us understand. Like, there's probably another Max Martin song about, like, not knowing who you are or, like, trying to find the right path that doesn't, I don't know. It felt like, you know, one of the many times where you think the audience is, it felt like it could be harmful, you know? Mm-hmm. It's like if you have someone coming in who is transphobic or just maybe not really understanding what's going on with that character. I mean, I didn't either. So, mm-hmm. and then they're like, oh, you know, this character doesn't know who they want to be. And they like, can't, I don't know. It just felt like putting that indecision in that character when they feel mm-hmm. so confident in like their identity actually was very conflicting.
Mm-hmm. I was a little confused about the love triangle that happened between Juliet and Francois or Frankie.
Mm-hmm.
It didn't seem like Juliet was really interested in Frankie or he was not interested in her, but I don't know why then it was like, we're getting married.
Yeah. Especially with both of them like trying to find their own independent paths. It was,
mm-hmm.
yeah, it made much more sense for Francois to be with May. I mean, which is what happens, but it's like, why did we even take this weird, messy route to get there? But
yeah, I mean, that is the very Shakespearean structure, yeah. right? Like you said.
I liked Francois though. He was like an endearing character and
yeah,
he was cute.
Yeah. I feel like for like a rich guy who's like sad he doesn't want to get married to this person, that's like a hard person to find and that I find endearing. So I feel mm-hmm. like the performer really pulled it off.
I think it was the performance. The performance is very like kind of awkward, nerdy guy vibes.
Yeah.
And he had a great voice too. So.
Mm-hmm. Oh, and another queer character in the show, Romeo.
Oh, yeah. Played
by Ben Jackson Walker. you find out, big spoilers, that he is not dead. And also at the funeral for him, Juliet finds all these like ex-lovers of his that includes so people of all genders. And yeah, I love that.
That was a great start to the play. And mm-hmm. I was like, oh my God, Romeo is like the Shane of this world. Everyone's just obsessed. It was so good.
And the performance, I felt like, pulled that off. I'm like, oh yeah, I could see how this guy would be like so popular.
Yeah, everyone's into him. But yeah, I think overall, even with the confusing gender situations aside, it's trying to, how do I want to say this? It's an excellent time at the theater. You have so much fun. And mm-hmm. I think it, you know, is genuinely trying to like create a super millennial experience that is accessible to many people. Mm-hmm. Whether or not it's doing that, I don't know. I enjoyed it. I would go again because the performances were so fantastic. And we also mm-hmm. saw the understudy of Juliet and I'd like
yeah.
to see.
Who was fantastic.
Oh my gosh. How is someone better than her?
Yeah. Her name, we saw Rachel Webb on for Juliet and it seemed like a very last minute replacement. Mm-hmm. And she crushed it.
Oh my God.
Yeah, she was amazing.
Yeah, her performance was, I couldn't believe it. Like intermission, my wife and I were like, how is someone else doing this? It seems like this character, you know, this actor has been like living in this forever. It was really good.
Yeah, and I love to go back and see Lorna too. So
mm-hmm.
I know Lucia brought up that she was annoyed that like Betsy Wolf's character has to like save Juliet in the end, which I totally right. see too. Mm-hmm. And I think that also has to do with the casting of that Juliet's a black actress in this production. But yeah, it is very much a vehicle for like Anne to be the hero of the show.
Yeah, Lucy was telling me this too on the way home and how it's like, why is Anne like the white savior of this show? And mm-hmm. see, Lucy, you're here even when we don't have you on as a special guest.
Yeah, it's great.
What would you say overall, recommend, Harrow?
I think so. I think just like going in knowing it's not going to, you know, be the non-binary queer representation you necessarily are like completely looking for, but it is the Broadwayfied version of it for now.
Mm-hmm.
But it is a good time.
It's a very good time.
Especially if you're into millennials music of the early 2000s.
And good choreography and costumes. You'll be
Praised by Lin-Manuel Miranda as the future of musical theater, SUFS creator Shayna Taub makes Broadway history as only the second woman to write the book, music, lyrics, and star in her own original new musical. Don't miss the much-anticipated Broadway debut of the singular artist that Forbes calls visionary and Billboard anoints as one of the most inventive voices in musical theater. SUFS, the original new musical from Shayna Taub, is now playing on Broadway at the Music Box Theater. Get your tickets today at SUFSmusical.com. The Outsiders on Broadway tells the story of finding where you belong when the world refuses to accept you. Based on S.E. Hinton's beloved novel, featuring new music from Jamestown Revival and Justin Levine, and directed by Danya Taymor, Entertainment Weekly says that with brilliant staging and some of the most captivating stage fighting currently on Broadway, The Outsiders has the power to inspire an entire generation. Get your tickets today at outsidersmusical.com.
And then finally, we saw a show yesterday, You Will Get Sick by Noah Diaz at Roundabout's Laura Pell's Theater and directed by Sam Pinkleton.
Yeah, and sadly, it will be over by the time this episode airs. But I do feel like this is a play that is going to be making a lot of rounds at regional theaters, colleges, because and also, I guess we have to say, too, because this is not, like, explicitly queer. We were mostly going to see it because Daniel K. Isaac is one of the stars of the show, and the main character is queer. I don't know who else is queer involved in the show, but odds are probably someone else.
Sure. And it was a lovely bit to know, or it was like a lovely layer to know the character was queer, but it also really had nothing to do with it. Like,
no,
could have been not queer. We could have not known. And it was just some nice like character world building.
Mm-hmm. This was like, I feel like this is a companion piece for me this year for American televisions. It's like another kind of surreal reality commentary. I think another real joy of it was getting to see Daniel K. Isaac and Linda Lavin together. Like, what amazing onstage chemistry in like a very different way than you're used to seeing older and younger actors interact, you know?
Yeah, that like intergenerational, well, summarizing the plot, Daniel's character
number one.
Yeah. The actors are numbered 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Daniel's character is sick, and he is coming to terms with that and puts up flyers, posters over around the city saying, please call me. I need to tell you something. I'm not ready to tell anyone else in my life yet, and I'll pay you. First he says $40, and then he crosses it out and says $20.
So Linda Lavin calls and ends up becoming like this pseudo care worker for number one as he's like dealing with his illness and telling people about his illness. And her character is hilarious. She's like going to night school to become an actor. Her age is not stated in the show, but she's definitely older. You could say she was a senior. And her dream is to be Dorothy in The Wizard of Oz. And that's a very, like, for her, it's not a joke, you know, like, this is her reality, this is her dream, and she's saving up money to get a Dorothy dress to really nail the audition.
Yeah, and it becomes this, like, transactional relationship where Linda Lavin's character is taking care of Daniel's character, and Daniel's, like, paying her cash for, like, every single act she does for him, basically. Mm-hmm. But you can tell that they're developing a relationship, they care about each other. But even by the end, he's like still giving her cash for supporting him. We stayed for the post show talk back too, and there were a lot of questions about that of like, why does she continue taking money from him, even though like they're clearly friends now or they care about each other? And like, we had talked about how like, or you, do you want to talk about how, what you were thinking about it? Cause I thought that was really insightful.
Yeah, as we were watching it, I thought about this book that we read in book club, I think about a year ago, called mm-hmm. Care Work, Dreaming Disability Justice. And it's Leah Lakshmi Peepsna Samasena. And there's a part of it where they're talking about like how eliminating the like, I'm doing you a favor, or, you know, different relying on friends and goodwill, and then instead having these transactional relationships can actually be a huge burden off of folks who need care, because like, you know, it's clear what we're both in this relationship for, we're both getting compensated, and it kind of eliminates the guilt factor. So that's what I kept playing as I was watching this happen, because, you know, the number one's at such a strange crossroads, and he, you know, has his boyfriend has just moved out. We find out he was taking care of him when he was sick. So it doesn't seem like he has someone close to him. And this seems like the way that he's been able to find comfort in being cared for is having that transaction rather than asking his sister or someone else out of kind of guilt or goodwill.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. I thought the play was like, was a great rumination, an exploration of mutual aid and how we take care of each other. And, you know, Linda's character wasn't necessarily disabled or identified as disabled, but like she is an elder. And in the talk back, Daniel said that Linda kept saying like, oh, disability is something that anyone could fall into at any time, basically, right? Which is definitely something I've heard in the disability justice community before. Like, you know, you could get sick, you could get hurt and instantly be disabled tomorrow, right? So I do think she was looking at it like mutual aid. And, mm-hmm. and, you know, he was helping her monetarily, but also it seemed like she was really lonely too. And so they were both getting something out of that relationship.
Yeah.
A lot out of each of the relationships.
It was refreshing and interesting to see a relationship where an elder is caring for like a younger millennial person. Because I was thinking if those roles had been switched, like if Daniel had been taking the money from her, I think it would have had a very different, for no reason, like just our own societal understanding of like, oh, you're exploiting that older woman, you know, but like having it flipped, you're a little more understanding of both sides, which that's probably a whole other conversation we could have.
Yeah. I was curious, like, how Daniel had so much money that he could just be, like, shelling it out to her like that. Because it was, like, it was a decent amount of money he was giving her. Especially if it was going to become, like, on a daily basis, that kind of money. And I'm, like, this is talking about capitalism, but I want it to go into that more of, like, what are the realities of his like medical bills? And, you know, he bought a wheelchair at one point in the show. Like, was that going to be reimbursed? Like, how is he just like have all the funds to like support this, I guess? And he didn't seem worried about money either.
I think the way that I read that, and now that you're saying that, I think I should have thought about it more. I thought like since he knew it was terminal and he was about to die, it was kind of like the end of what he had. So he was like, you know, these are, if I'm paying you $10 to take a sip of water, like this is, what am I saving for at this point? But yeah, it wasn't clear. How does he have all this money?
Yeah. Cause I'm even like, if he's like a young millennial, like that would run out so quickly.
Yeah. Could not afford that.
Yeah. Even like a few months of that. I'm just like, no, what millennial has the savings to do that?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I feel like with this show, if you would have told me before I went to see it that there was like a Wizard of Oz metaphor through it, I would have been like, ugh. And then like the way that it was done, I actually loved it.
Yeah. I saw production photos of it. So I had seen the like final, the like bow moment. Yeah. So I knew the big scene change was coming and I saw the Dorothy costume. So I kind of knew that was coming.
Oh, okay.
I really enjoyed the bird, metaphor that went throughout the play too. And like, there's a lot of mentioning of birds, especially like giant birds who are going to like come pick you up and take you away. And, as you discover that Daniel's character is like turning into a scarecrow, that makes a lot more sense.
Yeah. And like, maybe the birds aren't going to get him because he is a scarecrow, because he like scares them away. I don't know.
It reminded me a lot of The Wiz and like the antagonistic relationship the scarecrow has to the birds in The Wiz.
Oh, yeah. No, that's a good point. Yeah. It took me a while to figure out where it was going, because I had not seen the Dorothy costume, and I was like, oh, this is maybe people like start shedding hay because the birds are going to use them to make nests. I don't know. Mm-hmm. And then eventually I was like, oh, okay, this is Wizard of Oz. Once you start singing Somewhere Over the Rainbow. And then I read a review where they were talking about how the other characters are also symbolic of the Wizard of Oz, like the other actor who's always like playing characters who are upset or self-conscious or crying is supposed to be like a cowardly lion stand-in. But I didn't really think about that as I was watching it.
Hmm. Yeah, I didn't either. Mm-hmm. We had a revelation moment on the train together about the lions, tigers, and bears moment in the acting class. That was great.
Man, Noah Diaz probably thought that was we'll give them something easy so they can put it together.
It did take me a bit to like get my footing with the play as well. I think especially the narrator part of it. I thought it was Daniel who had recorded like voiceover.
So did I. Yeah.
Yeah. Kind of speaking Daniel's thoughts. It made it feel to me like I was reading a novel, because I'm like, I'm getting all the information as if I was like reading his thoughts in a book.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it reminded me of some of the newer games designs, like indie games, where it's like you're reading it and you have to make a choice kind of thing. Mm-hmm. But I really liked the narrator because it was so much of the narration was in second person. So it was like very implicating. And I think because Daniel's illness was unnamed and so vague, like the openness of it helped you. You could put your own specifics into it to find your story and experience. Mm-hmm. So I thought that was kind of genius, because it's relatable to everyone, whether it's yourself or someone you know. You know, it was really easy to like put your layer on top of the story.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, I was definitely thinking about like my worst fear case scenario of like, what if this happened to me or like my loved ones or, you know, like. Mm-hmm. I was actually just having a conversation with my friend Sam about this, three days before we saw the show, of like, oh, who are the people who we feel like we could call on if we got hit by a bus tomorrow and needed like intense care for a prolonged period of time? And how difficult capitalism makes that for us, even the people who we would like absolutely show up for, like, how much people still have to live their lives because of capitalism.
Yeah. And how difficult it is, like, even with things like family leave, like, you know, if we tried to do that for each other, we couldn't, you know, even though like we're connected a lot, I'm connected with you a lot more than family members. But because of the legal system, like, I couldn't take family leave to help a good friend. And
And who does that, like, how many people does that leave out without community? You know, the folks who are not in nuclear families or not connected with their parents because they're queer or trans or whatever, you know, like, you know, the people who that's hurting the most.
And the show title is like a promise, right? You will get sick. So it forces us to all think of this, because We will. All of us will get sick at some point, whether that's, you know, scarecrowitis or otherwise. Yeah. it's a weirdly light show for how heavy the topic is.
Yeah. And it had a lot of humor in it. That was great. Mm-hmm. And I think it was definitely needed, because it is such a heavy, dark topic. And the cast was great as well.
Yeah. And shout out to the Roundabout Education team for a great talk back after that. I have talk back anxiety because I don't know what questions people are going to ask. And it definitely like enhanced my experience of the play, getting to hear more about it.
Yeah, they set up some really great ground rules about, you know, what is appropriate to ask, at, especially ask, not comment on, to the actors. And I thought, the questions, yeah, were definitely the most questions and like relevant questions I'd ever heard at a talkback.
Yeah, it was great. So sadly, you can't go see it, but I feel like it'll be around. You'll be able to. You can also read it. I bet it would be a very fascinating play to read.
Definitely.
Okay, so just in time for the holidays, whatever holiday you celebrate, we wanted to share with y'all our action of the ep, which is Trans Santa. So this was founded in 2020 by India Moore, Kyle Lasky, and Chase Strangio. And Trans Santa was born of a desire to center trans care, joy, and giving at a time of escalating violence and attacks on the trans community. Trans Santa is a mutual aid social media campaign that connects anonymous gift givers with trans youth who are unhoused, in foster care, or otherwise without crucial support they need to thrive.
Trans Santa exists to show trans youth that they are loved and supported and that they have a family of people around the world who care for them, believe in them, and want them to succeed. Research shows that trans youth with supportive families have a 52% decrease in suicidal thoughts. Trans Santa aims to broaden our understanding of family and structural support so that our entire community can experience affirmation and love, even when those close to them may hurt or fail them.
Ultimately, our capacity for love, care, and connection can disrupt some of the structural limits on our survival opportunities and create more space for people to thrive and continue rich trans legacies of social and political transformation.
And there are three ways you can support them. You can buy gifts directly for trans youth with their gift registry links, donate money to Trans Santa and support the future of the project at transsanta.com/donate, and comment on posts from trans youth showing support.
So definitely recommend, if you do want to give to Trans Santa, you check out the link on their Instagram where they've shouted out lists that haven't gotten as many donations. So you can give love to those trans youth who are, who may not have received a gift yet. So it's also just really wonderful to look through the lists. And I don't know, as a high school teacher, it was cool to see like what, you know, kids are interested in and looking at, and, yeah, you can help them this holiday season. So we'll link to that in our show notes. Okay, so instead of doing a queer culture recommendation, I was inspired by one of my favorite podcasts, Pop Culture Happy Hour. And every year they do like a best of moment from the year in culture. And then they also do a resolution for the upcoming year. And on their show, the following year, they play the resolution and talk about how they did. So Wow. We can always revisit that later. but first, I wanted to know, Harrow, what was a favorite theatrical moment for you in 2022?
I think it has to be... I have two. Okay. One is...
That's
can
fine.
I do two? Okay.
Yes.
First one is more standard. It was Brian D'Arcy James as the baker in Into the Woods. Just emotionally destroyed me, especially his No More. Mm-hmm. I think that's like one of the performances I'm going to like take to the grave. And then my second, I think has to be I Want to Fuck Like Romeo and Juliet, and just
Yay! How
delightful that was. And, just like such, so nice to see such an amazing play and just have all the pieces of it really work for me. I just had so much fun at that show.
Nice. Yeah. Oh, that's great. And hopefully like that will be another moment that we get to live when I Want to Fuck Like Romeo and Juliet has a further life somewhere.
Yeah.
I hope.
What about yours?
So mine was finally after all of the buildup, seeing Strange Loop for the first time. I feel like the expectations were high after talking to you about it and then also talking to Elle Morgan and and talking to Mike, like, you know, talking to the playwright.
Sure.
So I was like, oh man, I have a lot going, like excitement. And met every expectation and exceeded it. And I would also say, because I'm going to cheat and have two as well, And my second moment would be when we went to the Breaking the Binary Theater Festival closing party and we got to meet so many of the artists that we had talked to on the podcast and mm-hmm. new queer artists and just see the community in action. And it just gave me so much like hope and excitement for the future as we're looking ahead to theater next year.
Now I want to replace – now that's – okay, top three. Yes, I agree.
Three is fine.
Can I also just share that, like, I started antidepressants at the beginning of 2022 and then, like, amped it up in May. And I saw some shows twice this year, some that I saw at the beginning of the year and some I saw, like, after the summer, and I'm like, oh, the antidepressants are working because I have such different emotional responses, like just any emotional response I saw later in the year. And I just want to like apologize to the shows I saw earlier in the year where I maybe didn't have as much like emotional space to really invest in them.
Those shows will forgive you. I know they will. And also it's not something you need to apologize for.
Yeah. I wish I could go back and like relive them, but you know. It's the world.
Maybe we need to write the company managers and explain the situation so you can get a... You're like, I'll provide data and research to your marketing team of how people on and off antidepressants react to the show.
Amazing.
Yeah. Oh, that's great. Three wonderful moments. So for theater resolution, I feel like we already do a great job with theater, like being theater patrons, right? We're good patrons. We talk about theater. So I'll share mine first. It's after having visited the Drama Bookshop finally for the first time after the remodel, I want to read more plays in 2023. Because I'm always like, oh, I missed that show. And I'm like, you know what I could do? I could just read the script. And that's not going to be the same, but I can still be part of the conversation. So, my goal is to read some more plays, which will also help with my Goodreads goal. So that's good.
Yeah, that's a great idea. Mm-hmm. So I think mine is, I did this a few years ago with books where I spent a whole year where I only read books written by either people of color and or queer or trans people. And now I just kind of do that all the time. Mm-hmm. So I kind of want to try and do that. I think I can't say like all the theater I'm going to see in 2023 will be written and by a person of color or a queer trans person because that's very limiting, sadly. But mm-hmm. I think the theater I'm going to pay for is going to be that. We'll see. I'm sure there will be exceptions, but that is going to be my goal.
Yeah, we'll take free tickets from anybody.
Yeah.
That's a great goal. And yes, sadly, I think without the pay exception, it would be limiting. So,
yeah.
But hopefully not.
It's hard because I know there's going to – I already have tickets for Late in the Piazza, and that doesn't meet that goal, so –
But you already bought it. This is for next year.
It's true. I bought it in 2022.
Yeah. We're not starting until January 1st.
So. Yeah. And I want to see Parade if it comes back. Yeah. So see, this is difficult, but I want to like.
Maybe someone could buy it for you. No, this feels
there
like.
There are workarounds.
Yeah.
I'm committing my money to where I want it to go.
Yes, exactly. No, that's a great goal. So I have, optimism that we will both meet these goals.
So, I do too.
And I hate like resolutions normally, but when it's involved with culture, I love it. So.
Yeah. What was your book, your Goodreads goal for this year?
It was 50 and I think I'm at 42.
Nice.
But I have three plays to read and I'm in the middle of like three books. So I should be good.
Amazing. You've been reading so much this year. I think mine's 40 and I'm like on track. I'm at like 37 or something.
Oh, you're good. Yeah.
Yeah.
You won't even have to cram a bunch of graphic novels at the end. You're good.
Yeah. I try and space the graphic novels out through the year. So I'm like, I stay on track.
Yeah. No, that's smart. I also saw that Daniel K. Isaac said that he needs more short recommendations for books because he's short of his Goodreads goal for the year.
Maybe we can discuss that with him soon.
Yes, hopefully. Well, have a happy holiday, Harrow. I hope it's full of good reading and I don't know what else I was going to say.
Dog
I was
going to
say theater,
family.
But yeah.
Yeah.
Dog time, yeah. Relaxing, macaroni and cheese because you make the best mac and cheese.
Thank you. And you make the best rest of the meal.
But the mac and cheese is everyone's favorite. It always goes first. It's the best. So
it's true. I did get a one piece to take home this year, which was nice.
Oh, good.
Yeah. Yeah, and I'm so glad we got to do another season together. And I'm super excited for what, you know, all our guests and show discussions for next year.
Yeah, good stuff ahead in season 4 already.
Yeah. And this season started with Paula Vogel.
Right.
And we, you know, our last guest was Sis. Oh my God. So it started with Paula Vogel and ending on Sis. And just that is, you know, this is my dream.
I would say two people that we had like dreamed about having on the podcast since the very beginning. So yeah, grateful to everyone who's been listening. And we hope that, you know, keep following along. Let us know what we should see. And I hope you have a good holidays.
See you next year.
See you next year. Bye, queers.
Thanks for listening. If you like, please rate and review us and share us with your friends.
So excited to hear your queer culture recommendations or any of your ideas on how we could queer the canon. You can call us, yes, actually call us and leave us a voicemail at 845-445-9251 or send us an email at thesisonjoan@gmail.com.
Until next time, keep it queer.
Not that it'd be that hard for y'all to do. Action of the ep first or the year wrap up?
Let's do action of the ep. Trans Santa!
Trans Santa!
They say well-behaved women seldom make history. Just ask the Supps. A vibrant and wholly original new musical, Supps celebrates the real women who changed history and their story that is more timely than ever. See the show Variety calls an epic tour de force new musical. Deadline Cheers is a rare Broadway feat and leaves audiences inspired to keep marching. Supps has arrived on Broadway and not a moment too soon. Get your tickets today at suppsmusical.com. If you love Broadway gossip, you are not going to want to miss any episode of this podcast, Singular Sensation, The Triumph of Broadway. Plenty of dramas unfold on stage, but the best dramas unfold backstage. And there were no bigger dramas than behind the scenes of Sunset Boulevard.
So you were being crucified over here, but not there.
No. No, because I was turning in a performance that would get standing ovations. Excuse me.
So check out my podcast, Singular Sensation, for all the juicy and gory details of Sunset Boulevard.